Added facades. The eight-letter words, interior instinct. Which is the right way? There is no right way. Or better, there are lots of right ways. Which is the right way depends on the purpose of the categorization. If you're compiling a dictionary, you want the first way, the B words, the F words. If you're compiling a thesaurus, you want the second way, the food words, the brain words. If you're worried about message length, you want something more like the third. Here's another warning. Categorization can fail for ethical reasons. We're all familiar with the ethnic and racial stereotypes that go hand in hand with discrimination and injustice. Those stereotypes generally come with a heavily negative connotation, with broad negative emotional implications. But there are also times when categorization itself may be unethical. Sometimes it's just plain wrong to think of people in terms of the groups they belong to, rather than as individuals in their own right. Categorization is an essential tool of thought, but like other tools, we have to be careful how we use it. What I want you to take away from this lecture are two fundamental ideas. We'll be using those ideas throughout the lectures that follow. First, the idea of concepts behind our words, the atoms of thought. Those concepts bring with them their own inherent structural relationships. A simple way of visualizing those relationships is Venn diagrams, subcategories within larger categories, subsets within larger sets. An expanded visualization is in terms of concept trees, hierarchical organizations of categories and subcategories, sets and subsets. Second, the idea of propositions behind our sentences. These are the molecules of thought, the stuff of evidence and deliberation, the working material of all rational argument. Categorical propositions can also be visualized in Venn diagrams. We'll use that visualization later as an easy in to all the logic of Aristotle. Before that, however, we'll explore the power of thought experiments. We often think of the world of imagination as something different from the world of reality, an escape into a purely mental realm of our own creation. But in fact, imagination can offer a wonderful route into reality. Really understanding what's happening around us, rather than just watching it, often requires thought that extends beyond the real into contemplation of what could be, or ought to be, or even into what can't be. In this lecture, I'll use some famous thought experiments as illustrations for more general strategies of effective problem solving. What these strategies have in common is the attempt to solve real problems with something distinctly unreal, the imaginative world of thought experiments. In a previous lecture, I talked about visualization and gave you a proof of the Pythagorean theorem with no math at all. Later in this lecture, I'll outline an Einsteinian thought experiment that lies at the core of relativistic physics, again with no math. I'll start with an example that emphasizes an extension of the visualization strategy. It's the strategy of going to extremes. How do you solve a jigsaw puzzle? Most people start at the edges. They go to the extremes because they're easier. Once they know the layout there, all the rest becomes easier. So try going to extremes in this example. There are two flagpoles, each 100 feet high. Tied between the tops of those poles is a 180-foot rope, which dangles 10 feet off the ground at its lowest point. How far apart are the two flagpoles? If you draw a picture, it'll be a picture of two flagpoles with a curved rope between them. At the bottom of the curved rope, you'll mark the bottom is 10 feet off the ground. But how far apart are the two flagpoles? If you want to try the problem on your own, press pause and come back. Some people might try to solve that problem by getting out a textbook and looking up parabolas. But there's a much easier way. Consider the extremes. What's the maximum distance the two flagpoles could be apart? 180 feet, since there's a 180-foot rope between them. At that extreme, the rope would be stretched taut, 100 feet from the ground at every point. How about the other extreme, the minimum distance apart? Well, they could be right next to each other. The 180-foot rope would just dangle down 90 feet on each side and 10 feet off the ground. We found the answer by going to extremes. The two flagpoles have to be right next to each other. Here's another one. We have an eyewitness to shoplifting in a coin shop. The witness says that the suspect had 6 pockets and that he saw him steal precisely 20 silver dollars. The report: he left with exactly 20 silver dollars in his pockets, at least $1 in each, and a different number in each pocket. Should we trust that eyewitness? Press pause if you want to think about it. We can use the strategy of going to extremes to examine the credibility of our eyewitness. With a different number of dollars in each pocket, the least number of total dollars has to be 1 in pocket 1, 2 in pocket 2, 3 in pocket 3, 4 in pocket 4. The least number of silver dollars that can be divided between 6 pockets that way is therefore 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6. That totals to 21 silver dollars, not 20. The suspect couldn't have divided only $20 between 6 pockets in the way the witness said. He would have needed at least 21 silver dollars. We've just refuted a theory by going to extremes. The quickest way to refute a theory is often to find a counterexample, and the quickest way to find a counterexample is often to go to the extremes. What we want in our theories, in both science and in philosophy, are universal generalizations, natural laws that apply in all circumstances. You can see how powerful universal generalizations are, if true. That's why we work so hard to try to get them. Their Achilles heel is that it takes only one countercase to refute them. If I say that something holds for all of a class, it'll take just one exception to prove me wrong. Galileo dropped a single cannonball and a musket ball from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. The physics of the time was Aristotle's physics, and what Aristotle had said was that heavy objects will fall faster, a universal law. That theory fits most everyday experience. Drop an egg and an empty eggshell off the top of a building, and the egg will hit first. Even Galileo started out thinking Aristotle must be right. But when Galileo dropped a cannonball and a musket ball, they hit at the same time. All it took was a single experiment. One simple case, and Aristotle's physics was soundly refuted. Galileo's was a physical experiment. But Galileo also offered a pure thought experiment for the same conclusion without actually dropping cannonballs. It went like this. Aristotle says that heavier objects fall faster than lighter objects. So take an 8-pound cannonball. If you drop that, it'll be falling pretty fast. If you drop a 4-pound cannonball, Aristotle says it'll travel slower. Here's the thought experiment. What'll happen if you tie them together and drop both? Aristotle says that the 4-pounder will be traveling slower. So it seems it'll hold the 8-pound cannonball back, like a little kid holding back his big brother. On this reasoning, the two cannonballs tied together should move slower than the 8-pound cannonball alone. But wait a minute. Tied together, the two cannonballs make a 12-pound complex. So the two together should move faster than the 8-pound cannonball alone. Aristotle can't have it both ways. Without dropping anything, with just a thought experiment, Galileo put all of Aristotelian physics into doubt. Someone makes a sweeping and general claim. The strategy is to look for a simple counterexample that might put that claim in doubt. Here's a famous philosophical thought experiment regarding the claims of artificial intelligence. In the flush of early success in artificial intelligence, Roger Schenck at Stanford claimed that with the right program, a computer could understand English. By instantiating the right computer program, he claimed, a machine could do precisely what we do. It could understand a natural language, English or Chinese. The philosopher John Searle calls that claim strong AI, and he regards it as pure hype. His ammunition against it is a thought experiment. Searle builds a counterexample in which Shank's program is running, in which any program you like is running, but no real understanding is going on. Shank had said that running the right program would amount to understanding. But if the program can be running when no understanding is going on, running the program can't amount to understanding. That's the strategy. Here's the Chinese room. Searle imagines himself as a man in a room with a very large rule book. The book has a column of input symbols on one side of the page. They just look like squiggles to him, Searle says, with a set of output squiggles on the other. The book has rules for which output squiggles to use given certain input squiggles. The room has an in slot and an out slot. Pieces of paper with squiggles come in on one side. Searle consults the book, copies out another set of squiggles, and drops those through the out slot. Suppose, Searle says, that the rule book is Shank's ideal program. Unbeknownst to the man in the room, the squiggles coming in the door are Chinese questions. The squiggles he puts out the door are Chinese answers. Given the right rule book, input and output would match inputs and outputs of any program that Shank might want to invent. But wait a minute, Searle says. The rule book is just a rule book. It doesn't understand Chinese. The room is just a room. No understanding there. And the man is just following the rules. He doesn't understand Chinese. Shank's program is running, but nothing in the Chinese room really understands Chinese. Searle points out that what a computer does isn't anything more than the guy with the rule book does. Nothing in the thought experiment case deserves to be called understanding, so nothing in the computer case does either. Searle's thought experiment took the debate into new and important channels, but it didn't end it. If following internal rules isn't enough to understand a language, exactly what is it that we do beyond that? Let me give you another philosophical thought experiment along the same lines, a single imaginative case intended to throw doubt on a grand general claim. This is Black and White Mary. It's a thought experiment from the Australian philosopher Frank Jackson. Jackson is out to show that there's something about consciousness that goes beyond the facts that science can give us. Mary is raised in a black and white world. Everything she sees is colored black, white, or some shade of gray, including her own image in a mirror. No color, just black and white. Despite that impoverished upbringing, Mary has become the world's leading expert on color vision. She knows all the scientific facts regarding color vision, derived, of course, from her extensive reading in black and white. One day, the black and white door is opened, and Mary walks out into the realm of color. Aha, she says, that's what red looks like. At that moment, Mary has learned something new. She now knows what red looks like. But she already knew all the scientific facts regarding color vision. The simple fact that red looks like that must therefore be something beyond scientific fact, something that science alone can't give us. Or so Jackson argues. Black and White Mary is famous for channeling discussion in certain directions, but Jackson's thought experiment can't be said to have settled the argument any more than Searle's did. Next to philosophers, those who love thought experiments most seem to be physicists. Maxwell's demon was a thought experiment that played a major role in the history of thermodynamics. Schrödinger's cat was a thought experiment central to debates regarding quantum mechanics. Here's a thought experiment crucial in the development of Einstein's theory of relativity. Just as he was a master of visualization, Einstein was a master of the thought experiment. Suppose a train car is moving along a track with Mike in the middle of the car. He passes Fred, who's standing on the platform. We assume that the speed of light is a constant. Bolts of lightning hit both ends of the train car. The light from the two bolts reaches Fred at the same time. He sees them hit simultaneously. What does Mike see in the middle of the car? Here it's crucial that the car is moving. The car is moving toward one lightning bolt, running up to and meeting the light coming from it. So Mike in the middle of the car will intersect light from that bolt first. The car is running away from the other bolt, adding distance for the light from it to travel. That light won't reach Mike until a little later. From Mike's perspective in the moving train, the bolt at the front of the train hit before the one at the back. It's called the theory of relativity, but it is in large part a series of deductions from the assumption that some things are not relative. What Einstein's thought experiment shows is that if the speed of light is not relative, observable simultaneity, whether two things are seen as happening at the same time, will be relative. Einstein also followed a firm methodological principle that theories must be written in terms of what is observable. When you rewrite this thought experiment purely in terms of what is observable, you can see how time and simultaneity will be relative to the comparative motion of two observers. That's the intuition at the core of Einstein's special relativity. Visualize. Go to extremes. If you're out to refute a theory, look for a counterexample. In all the examples I gave you, there's also something else at play. All of those involved using your imagination to simplify a problem. There are lots of ways to simplify. One is the strategy of analogy. If the problem you face seems resistant to your best attempts, think of a problem that's like it, but simpler. Some problems are hard just because they have a lot of parts. For those, a strategy of divide and conquer can prove effective. Solve the parts independently, then put them back together. A complex solution for a complex problem, but made of simple solutions to simple ones. Both strategies can be illustrated with the classic Tower of Hanoi problem. This is a hard one. You have three posts in a row. The right and middle posts are empty. On the leftmost post are stacked a series of six disks, ordered from largest at the bottom to smallest at the top. Your task is to end up with all six disks in the same order as they are now, but on either of the other two poles. But there are restrictions. You can only move one disk at a time. You can only move a disk from one pole to another. You can't just put it to the side, for example. And you can never put a larger disk on top of a smaller one. So how would you proceed? How many moves do you think it would take you to get all six disks from one pole to another? Gosh, where should we start? Well, we can take the top disk and move it to pole number two. Then the second disk has to go to pole number three, because it can't go on top of a smaller disk. Now I guess that the one on number two has to go to three. Oh, it's all so confusing, I'm lost. Cool it. Use a few conceptual strategies. First, visualize. You want to be able to see the problem. Maybe you were already visualizing the setup mentally as I described the problem. It's hard for me not to do that. Even better, draw a sketch of the three poles and the six disks. Then you can really see it, and not merely in your mind's eye. The best option of all is to get a three-dimensional version. You can construct that yourself. All you need are six disks, each smaller than the one before it. You could see the problem in 3D even if your poles were just three spots on the table in front of you. Each step, from mind's eye to two-dimensional drawing to the realm of three-dimensional manipulation, is a giant step in visualization. We want to know how many moves are required to move six disks from one post to another inside the rules. One disk at a time from pole to pole, never a larger one on top of a smaller one. The first strategy, visualize. The second strategy, simplify. If a complex problem has you blocked, try an analogous problem at a simpler extreme. It may not be what you were asked to do, but it may give you a clue as to how to do what you were asked to do. So, what if the problem wasn't about 6 discs, it was just about 2 discs? How many moves to transfer 2 discs from one post to another? That's easy. The top one goes to an empty pole. The bigger one goes to the other empty pole. The top one goes on top of it. That was 3 moves. But note that the top had to go somewhere that it didn't end up to allow the one underneath it to move. That's clearly going to be the case when we're dealing with more discs, too. Smaller discs have to go someplace to wait until we move a larger disc underneath them. So the 2-disc problem is easy. 3 steps. Now suppose you had 3 discs to move from one pole to another. Call them little, medium, and big. Well, little goes to pole number 3, say. Medium goes to 2, so they're laid out big, medium, little on the posts. Now, little can climb on top of medium there. That leaves this pole empty, and big can move there. That looks good. Now, one can go to this pole temporarily, letting 2 climb on top of 3, and little can finally go on top of that. That wasn't so tough. If you counted, that was 7 steps for moving 3 discs. Perhaps you can see a strategy in the simple cases that we can scale up to 6 discs. When we went from 2 discs to 3, we really moved the top 2 like when we were doing just 2 discs, then transferred the big disc to the bottom, and then moved the top 2 again like when we were doing just 2. I'll bet that doubling up of previous move patterns is going to happen with every additional disc. What if we try 4 discs? We'll go through the moves for the top 3, like we just figured, 7 steps, then move the super big disc on the bottom, then repeat the shuffle of the top 3. That'll be 7 moves plus 1 plus 7, so 15 moves for 4 discs. You see the pattern? The problem with 2 discs took 3 moves. The 3-disc problem took that many moves, plus moving a bigger disc, plus that many moves again, 7 steps. The problem with 4 discs was really the 3-disc solution, plus moving super big, plus the 3-disc solution. So for 4 discs, it's 7 steps, plus 1, plus 7, giving us a total of 15 steps. Scale that up, and you can see the pattern for 6 discs. The minimum number of steps for 5 discs is the number of steps to move 4, plus a move for the 5th one, plus the number of steps to move the 4 on top of it again, 15 plus 1 plus 15, 31. 6 discs is going to be that, plus 1, plus that again, 31, plus 1, plus 31, 63 steps for 6 discs. Here are the strategies we used. Visualization. Then, going to extremes. In this case, that just meant going to the simplest versions, 2 and 3 discs. From those analogous problems, the basic pattern started to emerge. Divide and conquer was at work, too. The 6-disc problem had the 5-disc as a component, the 5-disc had the 4-disc, and so forth on down. We started with an extremely simple form of the problem, and bootstrapped up from there. There's some psychological evidence that that often works as a strategy. The psychologist John Sweller gave some college students a starting number, 8. That was their number in hand. They were told to convert 8 to 15 in exactly 6 moves. At each move, they had to multiply their number in hand by 2 or subtract 7. One group got just that complex problem. The other group got 3 problems. The first 2 problems were simpler versions, parts of the whole. For example, start with 8 as your number in hand. At each move, multiply your number in hand by 2 or subtract 7. Can you get from 8 to 9 in 2 moves? Not too tough. 2 times 8 is 16, minus 7 is 9, from 8 to 9 in 2 moves. But how about getting from 8 to 15 in 6 moves? The solution here is to alternate operations. You can get from 8 to 15 by multiplying 8 by 2 to get 16, subtracting 7 to get 9, times 2 to 18, minus 7 to 11, times 2 to 22, minus 7 to 15. So Sweller gave one group just the complex problem. He gave the other group three problems, two simpler ones like the move from 8 to 9 and the complex one. So who got the hard problem fastest? On average, those who got just the complex problem needed an average of over 5 minutes to solve it. Those who got that problem after two simpler ones needed only about a minute and a half to solve the complex one. This statistic is even more telling. The group presented with only the complex problem took over 5 minutes to solve it. The three-problem group took an average of only a little over 3 minutes to solve all three problems. My colleague Marvin Levine, who gave me several of the examples in this lecture, says that someone faced with just the six-disc problem of Hanoi will take maybe 10 minutes to solve it. He predicts that someone who spends 5 minutes thinking about the two- and three-disc case will need only another 2 minutes to solve six discs for only 7 minutes or so in total. Not all thought experiments are out to prove something or to find the right answer. Sometimes thought experiments are explorations in a very different sense. There are imaginative explorations in epidemiology. If you didn't have vaccine for the whole population, where would it do the most good? There are imaginative explorations in economics. What changes in the financial structure would best stimulate employment? In business, many a startup triumph began in thought experiment. What if you could access digital information worldwide? What if you could social network online? Here's the thought experiment in the ethical realm, the runaway trolley. A trolley is running out of control down a track. The bad news is that it's hurtling toward five people tied to the track by a mad philosopher. The good news is that you're standing next to a rail switch. All you have to do is pull that lever and the trolley will go down a second track instead. The bad news is that the mad philosopher has also tied one person to the track on that side. What do you do? Do you do nothing, allowing the five people to die? Or do you pull the switch to save them, thereby sacrificing the one? This thought experiment was originally presented by the philosopher Philippa Foote. It was designed merely to point up differences in ethical theory. As it turns out, it may also reveal differences in the way different people approach ethical problems. In ethics, utilitarians hold that the right thing to do is that which results in the greatest good for the greatest number. They would clearly pull the switch, sacrificing one in order to save five. Would you? We can change the thought experiment at will. What if that one person on the second track is someone very special to you? Your mother, perhaps, or your child. Now would you pull the switch? Is that the ethical thing to do? A utilitarian would say it was. Here's another variation. This time there's no branch in the tracks. You're on a bridge above it as the runaway trolley rushes toward the five people. Only by stopping it with a large object can you save them. The good news is that there is a very large man sitting on the railing next to you. All you have to do is give him a shove. When he falls in front of the train, he'll be killed instantly, but his bulk will save the five. Should you push him off? Would that be the ethical thing to do? A utilitarian would still say yes. But perhaps you're now less inclined to be a utilitarian. It's not just philosophers who are interested in ethical thinking. The runaway trolley has been used with fMRI scans to explore the parts of the brain that different people use when thinking about the problem. Joshua Green is a psychologist at Harvard who has done much of this work. The first conclusion he draws is that there is no single part of the brain devoted to moral decision alone. There is no ethics central. Moral judgment recruits various portions of your brain. Green claims that people who arrive at different decisions in the runaway trolley use a different balance of brain areas. If you refuse to pull the switch when someone important to you was on the track, and you refuse to push the very large man off the bridge, emotional centers of your brain played a major role. Those emotional centers play a smaller role for utilitarians, dominated by more cognitive centers, focusing purely on the numbers of lives lost. The implications of Green's work remain controversial. Can any brain scan tell us whether something is ethically right? That looks like a question we might explore with further thought experiments. We've looked at thought experiments in the history of physics, as well as the history of philosophy and ethics and neuroethics. There's no rule book for imaginative thinking, but there are some general strategies. Visualize. Go to extremes. Simplify by analogy. Divide and conquer. In all these ways and more, give your imagination time to roam. The role of thought experiments in philosophy, physics, epidemiology, economics, and business make it clear that imagination isn't merely an escape from reality. Imagination is one of our finest tools for exploring reality. Imagination is one of our best routes in. In the next lecture, we'll return to simple visualizations that give us all the logic of Aristotle. The first attempts to analyze thinking systematically start with Aristotle, around 350 BCE. Aristotle's logic was the gold standard through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, indeed until about 150 years ago. In this lecture and the next, I want to concentrate on the logic of Aristotle. That will serve as a link between what we've discussed so far and what we're working toward. What we've emphasized so far are techniques for logical thinking, with visualization as an important component. Aristotle himself lays out his logic using a visualization. A visualization that takes up concepts and propositions right where we left off. What we're working toward is an understanding of the flow of rational argument. Aristotle's a major step in that direction. Later on, I'll have you put that understanding to work, analyzing arguments in the great debate. Let me start with a little history. The genealogy of Greek philosophy runs from Socrates to Plato to Aristotle. That transition of great minds is also a transition from oral to written culture. Socrates wrote nothing down. Indeed, he insisted that writing things down negatively impacts our capacity for memory and even for wisdom. Plato came next, transmitting the Socratic tradition to us in the halfway house of theater. Plato made Socrates a character in the plays we know as dialogues. In Plato's theatrical performances, an actor spoke as Socrates, and indeed spoke against writing things down, but the plays themselves were written. Aristotle studied with Plato for 20 years. He produced a range of popular works, including dialogues, the exoteric works, but none of those survive. The Aristotle we know is a scholarly writer, a writer of discursive treatises. Those are Aristotle's esoteric works, based on lecture notes, either his own notes or his students, or some combination of the two. He wrote on physics, astronomy, biology, the soul, and logic. I want you to try to visualize Aristotle. What did he look like? We know he had small eyes and spindly legs. The earliest visual representations show him bearded and balding. We know he either stammered or spoke with a lisp. I also want you to try to visualize the texts we're dealing with. Papyrus rolls, written in Greek, containing all the logic of Aristotle. I'll talk about the history of those texts a little later in the lecture. Aristotle is credited with the invention of logic. At the core of his logic, indeed of all logic, is this breathtaking idea. Maybe we can systematize thought. One of our greatest sources of power is our ability to think. But there are problems with thinking. It's often difficult, and it often seems to go only so far. But if we could systematize thought, we could perhaps make it less difficult. If we could formalize thought, we might be able to do the same amount of thinking with less thinking. If we could schematize thought, we might be able to make our thinking faster and more accurate and more effective. That attempt to systematize thought starts with Aristotle. There are some ideas I think that I could have had if I'd been at the right place at the right time. Maybe this is just conceit, but if I had been at the right place at the right time, I think I could have come up with the internal combustion engine. The mechanical elements were there in the steam engine: expansion in pistons, regulation by valves. The chemical elements were there in the combustion of petroleum. The internal combustion engine, that seems like an idea that I might have had. But there are some ideas that I think I would never have had. One of those is the very idea of logic. For that, we needed an Aristotle. Aristotle's work remains the core of logic all the way through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. At some point, Kant says that logic, and he means Aristotelian logic, is a perfected science in which no more progress can be made. That was at the beginning of the 19th century. Like all such predictions, it turned out to be wrong. By the end of the 19th century, we get the beginnings of what we consider contemporary logic. And the 20th was one of the great centuries in the history of logic. The computer age is grounded in logic. The idea of formalizing, systematizing, even of mechanizing thought stretches as one unbroken chain from Aristotle to the logic that drives your laptop. So let me give you the fundamentals of Aristotle's logic. A few lectures ago, we talked about concepts or categories, the atoms of thought. We used Venn diagrams to visualize our two categories, how they link together into what are called categorical propositions. Let me remind you. The categorical proposition, "No frogs are philosophers," looks like this. The proposition tells us that no frogs are philosophers. There's no overlap. Nothing is both a frog and a philosopher. So that middle area is empty. We black it out. All neurologists are MDs. There aren't any neurologists that aren't in the overlap. So we black out that left area. No neurologists over there. Some laws are unjust. For this, we used an X to indicate that there is something in the overlap. Finally, some inventions are not patentable. We use an X over the inventions area, outside of the patentable area, to indicate that some inventions are not patentable. Logic is about structure. Aristotle's first insight was that the structure of these categorical propositions isn't tied to their content. We can forget about frogs, philosophers, and patentable inventions. We can represent the structures themselves using just an S for the subject term of the proposition, any subject term, and P for the predicate. With that abstraction, we're looking at four basic types of categorical propositions. No SRP, all SRP, some SRP, some S are not P. That visualization leads to a second one, Aristotle's square of opposition. At the core of Aristotle's logic is a picture of the logical relations between those kinds of propositions. The four types of categorical propositions are on very specific corners of the square. All SRP is up there on the left. No SRP is up here on the right. Some SRP is lower left. Some SR not P is lower right. Across the top of the square are what we call the universal propositions, those that are all or nothing, all SRP, or no SRP. Across the bottom are what we call the particular propositions, the ones that are about some S. Not all, not none, just some. Some S are P, some S are not P. That's not all. Running down the left side are the positive propositions, all S are, some s are. Running down the right side are the negative propositions. Some are not, or none are. That's the setup. Universal positive, upper left, all SRP. Universal negative, upper right, no SRP. Particular positive, lower left, some SRP. Particular negative, lower right, some S or not P. Okay, I'll rattle off a few categorical propositions. As I do so, I want you to mentally position them on the square of opposition. For each one, ask yourself, is this universal positive on the upper left? Universal negative on the upper right? Particular positive on the lower left? Or particular negative on the lower right? All snakes are reptiles. No snakes are reptiles. Some snakes are reptiles. Some snakes are not reptiles. Those positions in order were left to right across the top, then left to right across the bottom. All snakes are reptiles is universal affirmative, upper left. No snakes are reptiles is universal negative, upper right. Some snakes are reptiles, particular positive, lower left. Some snakes are not, particular negative, lower right. I'll give you four more. As you hear them, drop them into place in your mental square of opposition. Some philosophers are not logicians. No philosophers are logicians. All philosophers are logicians. Some philosophers are logicians. Did you get those? They should have moved counterclockwise from the lower right. With the positions of each type of proposition firmly in your head, you're ready to see the real magic of Aristotle's visualization. First, look at the propositions on the diagonals. Those are contradictories. They can't both be true, and they can't both be false. No matter what S and P are, the propositions on the diagonals will contradict each other. It can't be true that all snakes are reptiles and also true that some aren't. No way, that's a contradiction. It can't be false that no philosophers are logicians, that would mean that some are, and also be false that some philosophers are logicians. That too is a contradiction. Now look at the relationship between top and bottom on the left and top and bottom on the right. All SRP top left, some SRP below it. No SRP top right, some S or not P below it. In each case, the top proposition implies the one below. That means if the top one is true, the bottom one has to be true too. If all tickets are winning tickets, some have to be. That's moving down on the left. If no tickets are winning tickets, some tickets have to not be winning tickets. That's moving down on the right. Now think of it from the bottom to the top on each side, and think in terms of false rather than true. If the bottom one is false on either side, the top one has to be false too. If it's false that some SRP, it must also be false that all SRP. If it's false that some S or not P, it must also be false that no S or P. Here's another way to express that relation. True at the top on either side gives us true at the bottom. That's the direction of implication. False at the bottom on either side gives us false at the top. You can think of that as counterindication. So let's sum up. Across the diagonals, both propositions can't be true and both can't be false. Those are contradictories. Going down the sides, if the top one is true, the bottom one has to be true. Those are implications. If the bottom is false, the top has to be false too. Counterindication. Two other aspects of the square are a bit more obscure. They're called contraries and subcontraries. Consider the propositions across the top. Those can't both be true. It can't be both true that all tickets are winning tickets and no tickets are winning tickets. But they could both be false. How? Well, if some are winning tickets and some aren't. The propositions across the top are called contraries. Both can't be true, but both could be false. The propositions across the bottom have exactly the opposite relationship. Both could be true, but they can't both be false. Let me give you an example. Both of these propositions could be true. Some men are professional football players, some men are not. But both couldn't be false. This is a little harder to see, but it's there. Suppose it's false that some men are football players. That must mean that no men are football players. As long as we have men, it follows that some men are not football players. But that gives us true on the lower right. Both lowers can't be false, but both could be true. Those are called subcontraries. How does all this help in everyday reasoning? If you visualize propositions as located on the square of opposition, you will instantly know the logical relations between them. I'm going to give you two propositions. I want you to tell me their logical relationship. Are they contradictory? Does one imply the other? Are they contraries? Start with these two. All bivalves are polisopods. Some bivalves are not polisopods. Drop them onto the square. They're diagonals. That's all you need to know. Contradictories, can't both be true, can't both be false. You don't have to know anything at all about polisopods or bivalves. From their form alone, the square of opposition tells you they're contradictories. How about these? All legal drivers are insured. Some legal drivers are insured. What's their relationship? We're going down the left-hand side of the square. So the first one implies the second one. If the first one is true, the second one has to be true too. If the second one is false, the first one has to be false too. One more. No absentee votes are counted. All absentee votes are counted. What's their relationship? Those are contraries. Both couldn't be true, but they could both be false. You can imagine Aristotle drawing his vision with a stick in the sand of Athens. My guess is that he was amazed. My guess is that he was convinced he was looking at the logical structure of the universe. Laid out in the square of opposition are all the relations between our four types of categorical propositions. Universal propositions, particular, positive, negative, contradictions, implications, contraries, and subcontraries. It's still a powerful image. I don't expect you to have gotten all the details in this brief presentation, but take some time to study the square of opposition, and you'll have the logic of Aristotle at your fingertips. I'll let some of that logic sink in while I fill in a little background history, just for fun. Aristotle's logic appears in a series of works collected as the Organon, or the Instrument, a set of lectures that outlined instruments for thought. Aristotle's Organon was the first philosophical toolkit lecture series. The Organon starts with the categories, just as we started with concepts. It includes the prior analytics, the posterior analytics, on interpretation. Those are the sacred texts of logic. Earlier in the lecture, I asked you to visualize the real man that was Aristotle, and the real texts that were those lecture notes written in Greek on papyrus. What happened to the originals? Can you see them in the Athens Museum? No, the history of Aristotle's texts is much stranger than that. We said that the intellectual genealogy went from Socrates to Plato to Aristotle. It actually goes one step farther, to one of Aristotle's students. Aristotle's father had been court physician to the court of Macedonia. Aristotle eventually became tutor to the son of Philip of Macedonia. The boy's name was Alexander, and he went on to conquer most of the known world. You know him as Alexander the Great. After Plato died, Aristotle founded his own school, the Lyceum. Funding came from his patron and former student, Alexander the Great. Aristotle died in 322 BC at the age of 62. The ancient biographer Diogenes Laertes tells us the text of his will. All will be well. But in case anything should happen, Aristotle has made these dispositions. In the will, he names his executor and makes provision for his second wife and his two children. He asks that he be buried next to his first wife in accordance with her wishes. His books were undoubtedly the core of the Lyceum's library. Those he leaves to Theophrastus, his successor as director. It's Theophrastus who takes charge of the Aristotelian manuscripts. We also have a transcript of Theophrastus's will. The important line is, "I leave all my books to Neleus." Neleus had known Aristotle. In fact, he was by that time probably the only living man who had been taught by Aristotle. It was natural for Theophrastus to assume that Neleus would become the new director of the Lyceum. But the scholars of the Lyceum didn't choose Neleus. They chose Strato. Neleus left in a tiff and took Aristotle's manuscripts with him. When Epicurus came to Athens as a 20-year-old, all the Aristotle he could get were the popular works, the exoteric works. Those have now disappeared entirely. The Aristotelian manuscripts? Neleus took them to his hometown, where they were buried in a cellar and passed down through his family for generations. The library at Alexandria tried to get them, but failed. If they had succeeded, Aristotle's logic might have disappeared when the library burned. Generations later, one of Neleus's descendants dug up the scrolls and sold them to a book collector named Apellicon of Teos. He took them to Athens, but they were decayed and full of holes by that time. But Apellicon thought of himself as a philosopher as well as a book collector, so he filled in the holes. That's been a problem for scholars ever since. Some of what we're reading may be Aristotle. Some of what we're reading may be Apellicon of Teos. In 86 BC, the Roman general Sulla sacked Athens. Apellicon was one of the first to fall, and Sulla took his library back to Rome. There, after dinner, he took pride in letting visitors see and copy out portions of Aristotle's manuscripts. Sulla bequeathed the original Aristotelian manuscripts to his son Faustus. Faustus was a spendthrift and eventually had to sell off everything he owned. It's at that point that the original manuscripts disappear from history. What we have are copies of copies, probably of manuscripts seen at Sulla's after dinner, with holes of decay filled in by Apellicon of Teos. Okay, let's get back to the logic. What the square of opposition gives us is a visualization for all of these: contradictions, contraries, implications, counterindications. Here's why those relations are important. Those are the logical relations fundamental for rationality in all the ways that rationality is important to us. Think of debate, an attempt to decide between conflicting views. That's what political debate is all about. That's what legal argument in a court of law is all about. That's what negotiation is all about. And when do two views conflict? Precisely when they are either contradictories or contraries. Think of the kinds of calculations we do in mathematics and engineering. Think also of the predictions we make on the basis of scientific theory. Those are all about implication. If this mathematical fact is true, so is this one. Given this scientific theory and given these initial conditions, this is what we can expect to happen. Think finally of how we test scientific theories. A theory predicts an eclipse at 12:30, but it doesn't happen. That theory has to be wrong. That's disconfirmation, crucial to all scientific rationality, and it follows the structure of counterindication. Rational debate, calculation and prediction, empirical tests and disconfirmation, the logical relations crucial to those are precisely those laid out in Aristotle's Square of Opposition. The visualizations we've developed also allow us to understand the logic of certain ways of transforming propositions. We'll be talking about transforming a proposition into its converse or its contrapositive. For certain types of propositions, on specific corners of the square, these transforms give us immediate inferences. If the original sentence is true, so is its transform. But it'll be important to remember what positions on the square these work for. Let's start with the converse. That transform holds for propositions in the upper right and the lower left. The universal negative, no SRP, and the particular positive, some SRP. If one of those is true, It'll still be true when you switch subject and predicate. If it's true, it'll still be true. If it's false, it'll still be false. But remember, that holds only for upper right and lower left. So take the proposition, no fish or reptiles, universal negative, upper right. And if no fish or reptiles, no reptiles or fish. Some experimental failures are scientific breakthroughs. Switch subject and predicate and you get some scientific breakthroughs are experimental failures. If one's true, the other is. If one's false, the other is too, an immediate inference. If some cleaning products are poisons, it follows immediately that some poisons are cleaning products. If some primates are philosophers, it follows immediately that some philosophers are primates. If you go back to our Venn diagrams, you can see exactly why converse works for the upper right and lower left. Look at our Venn diagrams for those. Both diagrams are symmetrical. One says there is something in the overlap area and puts an X there. One says there's nothing in the overlap area and blanks it out. But the overlap is the same, whether you think of it as the overlap between S and P or the overlap between P and S. It doesn't matter which one you make the subject term and which one you make the predicate term. What the proposition says is the same in each case. They're equivalent. The other forms of proposition, the upper left and lower right, are not symmetrical. The converse is not guaranteed to hold for those. But there is a transform that does hold for those. It's called the contrapositive. In order to understand it, we have to introduce one more concept, the complement. Let's take the category senators. The complement is the category of everyone who isn't a senator, the non-senators. Or consider all the poisonous substances, and consider the substances that aren't poisonous. Those two categories are complements. You take the two categories in a proposition and you use their complements in order to arrive at the contrapositive. While leaving everything else the same, you switch subject and predicate, but this time you also replace each by their complement. If you're dealing with the upper left or lower right corners of the square, that again gives you an equivalent proposition. That again gives you an immediate inference. All senators are congressmen. Switch subject and predicate and replace them with their complements. All non-congressmen are non-senators. All people are primates. Switch subject and predicate and replace them with their complements. All non-primates are something other than people. The inference is immediate and guaranteed. But try this on your friends, and you'll see how difficult it is for people. Next time they say something like, "All the widgets are defective," say, "Do you mean that everything that isn't defective isn't a widget?" The logical inference is immediate, but you'll be amazed how long it takes them to process it. Contrapositive works for the lower right too, but this does get a little tangled. If some liquids are not flammable, some non-flammable things are liquids. I canceled a couple of double negatives there. In summary then, for upper right and lower left, the converse gives you an immediate inference. You can just switch subject and predicate. Converse isn't guaranteed for the other two. For upper left and lower right, the contrapositive gives you an immediate inference. You can switch subject and predicate and replace each by its complement. Contrapositive isn't guaranteed for the other two. Let me try you on these. These are immediate inferences. With a square of opposition clearly in mind, you should be able to give me these answers even without thinking very hard. Everyone on the committee supports the measure. Does that mean that everyone who doesn't support the measure isn't on the committee? Yes, immediate inference. That's the contraposition of the upper left corner, and that guarantees equivalence. Some registered voters support the measure. Does that mean that some people who support the measure are registered voters? Yes, immediate inference. That's the converse of the lower left. Equivalence guaranteed. Some registered voters support the measure. Does that mean that some who do not support the measure are not registered voters? No. That's a contrapositive transform, but in this case it was applied to the lower left. No guarantee. That might be false. Contrapositive is only guaranteed for upper left and lower right. What I hope you'll take away from this